The Gary Knoll Show, daily at noon on the Progressive Radio Network.
Live from New York City, it's the Gary Knoll Show. And now, your host, Gary Knoll.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll, and I'd like to welcome you to this Empowerment Hour. I can promise you we will share insights, information that will give you options and alternatives to what otherwise might have been not the best of choices. We're going to, for example, have a commentary on Obama's religious problem. The White House is funding enormous amounts of money to discriminatory religious groups. Why? Well, that leads us to a commentary from Frank Schaefer on Inside the Christian Right and how it's aiming to destroy all things public. What people will do to buy a vote, and what happens when you align yourself with people who are, well, they're racist, they're insensitive, and yet they're true believers. This is the story you have not heard. These are the details from an insider. This is a person who was a part of that. And why it's so important that we listen to someone who was inside that whole movement at the very top, who was friends with James Dobson and Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson and all the others, and how... Now we're going to get an insider's look at how many people end up seeking the support of a radicalized group because they can help get you elected. What do they get in return? That'll be in our commentary section. Also, in our issue section today, I'm going to ask you to address this issue, please. I believe that Osama bin Laden is dead. I'm not sure if he was actually killed as stated in Pakistan under the conditions we have been told, because the story has changed now 10 times. But behind all this is something that just doesn't make sense. And here is my proposition for you to consider. We know that the National Security Agency monitors through Operation Echelon every single email and phone call in the world. We also know they look for key words that will differentiate a normal conversation that would not interest them from one that may lead them to someone on their wanted list or some terrorist organization. We also know that because the CIA and the national security agencies, of which there are 16, have known for a long time that the money that we have been giving to Pakistan, over $20 billion, none of that got into the Pakistan public's support system. No new schools, no better roads, no better farming system. It went into the military, and it went into the people who had the intelligence services. What did they do with it? Well, they bought arms from the United States. That's part of the deal. That's something people are not aware of. We'll give countries money, providing in return they buy from our armaments industry. It's a circle. We end up with money back, but not to the public in the U.S. Treasury, but into corporate pockets. But we've known that they've been supporting the Taliban. We've known that they have knowledge of 9/11 that they have not told us. We know we have an incomplete story. We know we're aiding and abetting the people who are supporting our enemy. That is no secret. We also know that every single major phone service, internet service, everything that can be monitored from any form of surveillance has been done in Pakistan. Wasn't it interesting? Maybe they thought it wasn't important, but in the release of information, we were told that bin Laden was working actively on his emails, on his computer, which they claim they got the hard drives on, and that he had been daily working, directing his terror network to carry out more plots. So here's the issue. It's simply a question that I think any legitimate, concerned person would ask. If bin Laden was directing this whole terror complex over the internet from Pakistan, and we had every computer and every internet outlet in Pakistan being monitored every second of the day, every day of the year, how is it that we didn't know that he was doing all this and hence track it right back to where he was? Also, we're now told that the CIA had a safe house near him and therefore had the technology to monitor every conversation and know what he was doing, who was in the house, who the people around him were, and his significance. We also would have known by that who were the individuals protecting him, because you do not get that kind of protection unless you give something in return. By killing him, which had to have come from the President of the United States, you have to understand that Navy SEALs are the most disciplined, highly trained, and efficient soldiers in our entire military complex. They don't make mistakes. They don't do something on impulse, ever. No one could have given the kill order except the Secretary of Defense, in consultation with the National Security Agency and the Joint Chiefs of Staff. That order could not have been supported unless it was by the President of the United States. Knowing that he was not armed, knowing that he could easily have been apprehended without even a gun. After all, these are Navy SEALs. These are tough hombres. And knowing already who was in the house and that all these individuals had been neutralized, had they taken him alive, three things we would know. One, we would find out who was supporting terrorism, backing it financially. Would that have embarrassed us or put us in a difficult situation if we found out, as I suspect, that Saudi Arabia and the royal family, or members of the royal family, were supporting this entire effort all along? It would have told us that people high up in the Pakistani government and in the intelligence agencies were not only supporting bin Laden, but also supporting terrorism, and we would have known the details. It would have also told us what were the key decisions made when bin Laden was under the control of the Taliban and the Taliban wanted, prior to 9/11, to turn him over to the United States, and then after 9/11, wanted to turn him over to the United States, and we rejected it both times. The details of those discussions and meetings, he would have been able to talk about. So we would have gone back to our presidents and advisors and under oath ask him, you had a chance to get bin Laden before this. You had a chance to get him after 9/11. Why did you not apprehend him? Think of all the answers we would have had he just been taken prisoner. So here's my question. Is it even conceivable that a man could have been working on his computer, directing a terror network via his emails, without America knowing about it, since they read every single American's emails, listen to every single cell phone call? Remember what I'm saying. Listen to what I'm saying. Every single call you make, every email you make, every text message you make is monitored. There is no such thing as having any human being in the United States who can make a call without it being monitored. That's the capacity they have. That's what worries me. That concerns me. Doesn't seem to concern others on the left, but it concerns me because I'm concerned about the erosion of our constitutional rights and guarantees. I'm concerned about creeping fascism. I'm concerned about a form of corporate totalitarianism. I'm concerned of corporations having the power to virtually control our governmental agencies and those people who are elected by us, but really under their control. These things concern me. If this was the 1960s, there'd be a lot more of me's being concerned. But too many people today don't think this is an issue. I do. What are your thoughts on this? How much of what we've been told about all this, bin Laden, do you believe is real or not real? My guest in the second part of our program today will be Dr. David Riccio. And we're going to talk about daring to trust, opening ourselves to real love and intimacy. Let's start. Pump up your potassium intake. We know we take way too much sodium, and that can cause high blood pressure, destroy our kidneys. It creates a sodium-potassium imbalance at the cellular level. New research shows that when we start eating fruits and vegetables, nuts and seeds, we naturally increase our potassium intake, and that naturally lowers our sodium intake. We need, I would say, about 300 milligrams average, it can change, in the food we get in a day, and that's what we need, we're up. Most people know that bananas or orange juice are fairly good in potassium, but there are a lot of other things that are actually better. I would like to see people eating more grapes, and I'd like to see them having more walnuts and almonds, potatoes, especially red potatoes, and Yukon potatoes are a rich source of potassium, lots of potassium, and nuts galore because they really have a lot of good potassium. So increase your potassium, decrease your sodium. It can protect your heart and also increases your energy. And especially if you're outside when you're sweating and exercising, biking, jogging, walking, have an electrolyte drink. What's the best one? Watermelon juice with some lemon in it. And if you have some ice and you blend the ice with watermelon and lemon, it's a great thirst quencher, and you're getting your electrolytes and you're getting your potassium back into your system. Next up is dark chocolate. I mentioned last week why dark chocolate was so good for us. I'm adding on to that today because a new study shows from the European Journal of Nutrition that if you consume some dark chocolate prior to exercising, you can decrease the potential muscle damaging effects of the oxidative stress. Remember this. Everyone who exercises creates oxidative stress. That prematurely ages you. That's a bad thing. Exercise strengthens your muscles, reduces body fat, increases the endorphin feel-good hormones, increases circulation to the brain and extremities, helps to speed up digestion and peristalsis, helps the liver release toxins. All good thing. But you end up in this irony of having muscles that are healthier, heart that's healthier, brain that's healthier, but you've prematurely aged yourself. So you have to compensate. The compensation are antioxidants. Whether your antioxidants comes from juices, tablets, or foods or powders is irrelevant, but you've got to get the antioxidants in. Well, the flavonoid-rich dark chocolate is rich in orac, rich in antioxidants, so therefore having a 70% coca will absorb those free radicals that you produce from oxidative stress when you're exercising and therefore allow you to come out of your exercise having all the upside benefits and none of the downside. This is from the University of Wales. Quote, we believe that small effects observed here could be physiologically important from the coca-induced metabolic changes leading to modulation of a major plasma constituent. In addition, dark chocolate was affected at blunting the exercise-induced increase in plasma total antioxidant status observed in other trials. So it just means that some chocolate or coca is going to help you. If you can't do it before you exercise, do it, have that health shake within about 20 minutes afterwards. And finally, deprivation and neglect found to age children's chromosomes. Now, this was institutionalized children, and they had prematurely shortened telomeres, a mark of cellular aging. This was at Children's Hospital in Boston. And they did the study and found that Romanian children who had spent time in social institutions and were socially deprived and neglected, had lower IQs, lots of behavioral problems, but prematurely aging. This was published in Molecular Psychiatry. So what does this mean? It means that the telomeres designed to protect the chromosome. It means that the longer the telomeres, the longer your life. The shorter the telomeres, the shorter your life. Anyone who is incarcerated, anyone who is institutionalized, anyone who is in a confined environment, either at work or at home, where they feel isolated and neglected, it is turning your biochemistry against you. You simply will die sooner and you'll have a lot of emotional and physiological problems. If nothing else, we should have at this point in our life, we should have enlightened individuals realize that the existing system of incarceration, with the exception of very violent crimes, is counterintuitive and counterproductive. Now think of all the children who are neglected, who don't get the quality time with their parents, fun time, joyful time, creative time, study time. They can be in the same home, but if there's not quality time, that also can impact them. And by the way, one more study from Science Daily, from the Journal of Aggression, Maltreatment, and Trauma, it says childhood physical abuse linked to chronic fatigue syndrome. This is another one of those situations. Whatever happens to you in childhood can end up manifesting the rest of your life. Children who were physically abused ended up with chronic fatigue syndrome at a very high level. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. Everyone, I'm Gary Nall. Now let's go to our issues, and I'm going to do an abbreviated version of this, and then we're going to have Elizabeth. In fact, we're going to reverse it. I'll have Elizabeth and who read your emails while I'm on the road, and I'm on the road now, and then I'll do this abbreviated issues, then have you call in with your points of view. I look forward to hearing from you. Hello, Elizabeth.
Hello, Gary. Hello. Good morning to you. We've had an email from Elaine in response to yesterday's commentary on Obama and Cornel West. Mm-hmm. I will read it. It's quite short. I'll read it to you. Cornel West is a lovely man and a poet, but in this moment he sounds like a crybaby or a jilted schoolgirl. To me, he sounds like if Obama had gotten he and his mom tickets for the inauguration instead of the bellman, things might be different. How many times have I worked for ungrateful characters because I believed in what they were doing? If they go off the rails, I fight even harder to make sure they hear my point of view and try to get them back. I don't trash them publicly for personal slights. I mean, do what you do, but do it for yourself and don't expect any thanks. And how typical of someone to expect favors for helping with a campaign and then to write about it. That's what is great about Cornel West, seriously, the honesty, and I really respect it, but I don't agree. Tavis Smiley is possibly the same way. He's just annoyed that he didn't ascend to the proper throne because Obama didn't come on his show or announce there and give him his rightful place as first and foremost, etc., etc. Obama is in a serious game, and he is not playing some of it well for sure, but Brother Cornell's comments sound petty and ill-informed instead of constructive. Maybe some people have enough money to survive two election cycles. I personally can see why some people are trying to work within political systems, even though I do not necessarily agree with that approach. And the bathwater is filthy dirty, that is for sure, but some people are trying not to throw the baby out with it. They have fought inch by inch, and for the little progress they have won. They may not be willing to let another Bush devastation occur, nor give up what little hard-fought ground they have won. They are taking what they feel is their best shot. Now, this is obviously in contrast to yesterday, so would you please be able to give your opinions and address this for us?
Arthur Koestler said, nothing is more sad than the death of an illusion. And Arthur Miller, the great playwright, said, the task of the real intellectual consists of analyzing illusions in order to discover their causes. Before Obama was nominated, I looked at his background. I looked at who gave him money and what he voted for. I have not found that Obama has been inconsistent or betrayed his fundamental virtues. He is a corporatist. He is a Clinton Democrat. And therefore, he has honored the commitments to the people who've supported him from his days in Chicago. He is pro-war. He is pro-major corporation. He funded the bailout. He supported the TARP program. He has not caused a single home from being foreclosed on. He has not changed the way that the poor, the middle class, the working class are dealt with in our society. The only time they'll ever hear from Obama is when he goes before them to enrapture them that he is one of them and he has got their interests at stake. He does not. When I made that comment that what you're going to get with Obama is someone who is pro-nuclear, pro-coal, pro-scraping the mountains of Appalachia because he worked for the coal industry to do that. He is pro-nuclear in a big way. Largest single campaign contribution from any industry in the energy sector came from the largest owner of nuclear facilities, and they had on their advisory panel Ron Emanuel, who became his chief of staff, and one of their chief lobbyists was David Axelrod. Why in the world would we expect him to do anything except what he had done? And yet the American public doesn't want to acknowledge that because they're living with the illusion that he would be different. And I'm sure that that also applied to Cornel West and many others. Because Obama's very smart and he can be very friendly and persuasive. Now tell that to all the people today who don't have enough food to feed their children, 14 million. Tell that to the people who've lost their homes, 24 million.
Right.
Tell that to the people whose jobs were secure until bailouts occurred or until companies got enough money to offshore their manufacturing facilities so they no longer had to honor unions, workmen's compensation, environmental, or OSHA rules and therefore could profit by very cheap labor. Tell that to about 12 million. Go into the area of Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama, Florida, and Texas that have been devastated by the Gulf Shore disaster and explain to them the legitimacy of opening up new deep water drilling. Look at the evisceration of our health care plan where we were promised a single payer, but it was betrayed. We were promised environmental regulation. We were betrayed. We were promised that that there would be no more corporate advantages. We were betrayed. I remember being invited by Julie Ratner, who at that time was the wife of Bruce Ratner, one of the most powerful political people, financial people. His brother is one of the lawyers or the was lawyer for Pacifica, and their big real estate had this big development over in Brooklyn. And it was all about Clinton. I had already done my investigation on Clinton. I found him to be a very loathsome person. His reputation out of Arkansas was deplorable. But at any fundraising gathering in New York, the people you're going to meet are people who are positioning themselves to receive the favor when a person, if a person gets into office, remember me, I was there, I wrote a check. Remember me, I wrote a good editorial. Remember me, I stumped for you on the campaign trail. Remember me, I introduced you to Steven Spielberg. Remember me, and suddenly all those people, and there are legions of them, thousands of them, all line up expecting to have a seat at the table, or at least be at a table in the room. They expect to now be considered one of the new elite. The Democrats play this game with the same ferocity as the Republicans. These are people who are almost all well-educated, coming from the best institutions, who work in powerful positions, dominating the movie industry, dominating Wall Street, dominating banking, and they are very assertive. Most are dynamic energies. So when you look at who's around Obama, Timothy Geithner, Larry Summers, these are Clinton's former Secretary of the Treasury and chief financial advisors. And their mentor was Robert Rubin, the man who got his company, Goldman Sachs, bailed out when the peso collapsed because it was shorted by George Soros. All these people believe that as long as they're supportive in name and title of the person in power, that they must go along with supporting that. So now you have someone who says, I wasn't invited, Cornel West, I wasn't invited to the inauguration, I didn't get a ticket, the bellman in my hotel did, woe was me. I don't believe that that's the issue. I don't believe that that's what bothers him. I believe that what bothers him is the fact that when he began to look for the real Obama, and not the one that the illusion was based upon, the ideal was based upon, the desire was based upon, he came to have to agree that this was just another corporatist who happened to have been African-American.
Right.
And therefore, he now, I believe, could not and would not support, now this is only my opinion, Obama, because he's no longer willing to support the illusion. Remember, you can only support something providing you support the illusion that's connected to it.
Yeah.
If people think that supporting a particular actor is important, or supporting a restaurant is important, or supporting a baseball team, or whatever it is, you first have to build an illusion, because your belief doesn't come from your direct, intimate relationship with another person. It doesn't come from the facts on the ground. It comes from what is built around that person, the persona, the mystique, the facade. And we have companies that manufacture dissent, manufacture consent, manufacture our capacity to be motivated into a war, or manufacture our capacity to believe that someone is guilty when they're innocent, or innocent when they're guilty. Everyone in the United States today, every single man and woman who's done anything to contribute to our health and well-being, who believes in a more humanistic, philosophical, spiritual way of dealing with life, and there are many, those people are going to be on a quack watch list. Those people, which is a form of like, once you're on that list, the media will not treat you with respect. You will not get funding. You will not be taken seriously. How do you take a Nobel Prize winner like Linus Pauling, who won a Nobel Prize too, the only American to ever win two unshared Nobel Prizes, how do you take a man like that, who got a Nobel Prize in chemistry, and say that he is a quack? Why? Because he believed that vitamin C, based upon experience and experiments at the Linus Pauling Institute, could help prevent cancer and heart disease and diabetes, and he published his results. But the quackbusters could not align themselves with that because it wasn't pharmaceutical. And the pharmaceutical industry felt threatened. If Linus Pauling gets people to take vitamin C 18,000 milligrams a day, which is what he was suggesting, then they're not going to take our drugs, let's say, or over-the-counter medication or aspirin. So then they began to create a facade to show that one of the most important scientists in American history was not to be trusted. They disempowered him. No one would quote him as a legitimate source. So one of the five greatest scientists in American history was relegated to being a quack for no other reason than they were capable of manufacturing dissent. And that's what they did. So understand that behind Obama is one of the most perfect machines for creating illusion that has ever existed. Just like Hillary had a machine to woe the women. We want a woman in president. We want a black in president. We want a Latino in president. No, we shouldn't want a black, a woman, or a Latino as president. We should want the best person capable of acknowledging everyone's right to be treated correctly and honor the commitments to everyone in our society. Anyone who is a woman, Latino, or black, or anything else, that is simply secondary. That is what they are as a human being, but it's not what they're bringing into their office. And so when we get caught up in the illusion that a woman president would be more sympathetic and understanding of a women's rights movement, not true. some of the most powerful women in government have been anti-feminist. One woman in particular protected a rapist. Know that for a fact. So be very careful what you believe in and step back before you give your commitment to something and ask how much of what I'm believing in is myth based upon illusion, and then could I handle the reality? And then you can start. Okay, that's how I would answer that letter.
Brilliant, thank you.
All right, now I'm looking at the clock. Got a little bit of time here. I'll put this into perspective. I'm going to do one part of this. And this is from Frank Schaefer. This is his story, and I'll quote it. Ironically, at the very same time that evangelicals like my father and I were thrusting ourselves into bare-knuckle politics in the 1970s and 80s, we were also retreating to what amounted to a virtual walled compound. In other words, we lashed out at godless America and demanded political change, say, the reintroduction of prayer into public schools, and yet also urged our followers to pull their children out of public schools and homeschool them. The rejection of public schools by evangelical Protestants was a harbinger of virtual civil war carried on by other means. Protestants had once been the public school's most ardent defenders. For instance, in the 1840s, when Roman Catholics asked for tax relief for their private schools, Protestants said no and stood against anything they thought might undermine the public schools that they believed were the backbone of moral virtue, community spirit, and egalitarian good citizenship. The evangelicals' abandonment of the country they called home, while simultaneously demanding change in that society, went far beyond alternative schools or homeschooling. In the 1970s and 80s, thousands of Christian bookstores opened, countless new evangelical radio programs flourished, and new TV stations went on the air. Even a Christian Yellow Pages, a guide to evangelical tradesmen, was publishing and advertising Christian plumbers, Christian accountants, and the like, who honor Jesus. New evangelical universities and even new law schools appeared, seemingly overnight, with a clearly defined mission to take back each and every profession, including law and politics, for Christ. For instance, Liberty University's law school was a dream come true for my old friend Jerry Falwell, who, when I was speaking at his school in 1983 to the entire student body for the second time, gleefully told me of his vision for Liberty's program. Frank, we're going to train a new generation of judges to change America. This was the same Jerry Falwell who wrote, "In America Can Be Saved," quote, "I hope to live to see the day when, as in the early days of our country, we won't have any public schools." To the old-fashioned conservative mantra, big government doesn't work, the newly radicalized evangelicals and their Roman Catholic and Mormon co-belligerents added, the U.S. government is evil. In the very same community, Protestant American evangelicals, who had once been the bedrock supporters of public education and voted for such moderate and reasonable men as President Dwight Eisenhower, became the enemies of not only the public schools, but also of anything in the non-military public sphere run by the government. As they opened new institutions outside of the mainstream, the Jesus victims, doing this reclaiming, cast themselves in the role of persecuted exiles. What they never admitted was that they were self-banished from mainstream institutions, not only because the evangelicals' political views on social issues conflicted with most people's views, but also because evangelicals and other conservative religionists found themselves holding the short end of the intellectual stick. Science marched forth, demolishing fundamentalist so-called facts with dispassionate argument. So science also became the enemy. Rather than rethink their beliefs, conservative religionists decided to renounce secular higher education and denounce it as elitist. Thus, to be uninformed, even willfully and profoundly stupid, came to be considered a godly virtue. And since misery loves company, the evangelicals' quest, for instance, when evangelicals dominated the Texas textbook committees, was to strive to balance the teaching of evolution with creationism, and damn the facts, science doesn't count. In the minds of the evangelicals, they were recreating the Puritan self-exile from England by looking for a pure and better place, this time not a geographical place, but a sanctuary within their minds, and in inward-looking schools and churches undisturbed by facts. Like the Puritans, the post-Karl Rove evangelicals and many other conservative Christians withdrew from the mainstream not because they were forced to, but because the society around them was, in their view, fatally sinful and worse, addicted to facts rather than faith. And yet, having dropped out, the evangelicals nevertheless kept on demanding that regarding moral and family matters, the society they'd renounced nonetheless had to be conformed to their beliefs. In the first decade of the 21st century, the evangelical and conservative Roman Catholic and Mormon outside victim approach to public policy was perfected on a hitherto undreamed scale by Sarah Palin. She was the ultimate holier-than-thou evangelical queen bee. What my mother had represented in her unconstructed fundamentalist heyday to a shallet full of young, gullible women, and later to tens of thousands of readers, Palin became, for tens of millions of alienated, angry, white, lower-middle-class men and women convinced that an educated elite was out to get them. Palin was first inflicted on the American public by Senator John McCain, who chose her as his running mate in 2008 presidential election for one reason only. He needed to shore up flagging support for the evangelical Republican anti-abortion base. McCain wanted to prove that he was fully in line with the social issues agenda the dad and others had helped foist on our country over 30 years before. Palin lost the election for McCain, but won her war for fame and fortune and self-appointed prophetic person. She presented herself as called by God and thus cast in the Old Testament mold of Queen Esther, one chosen by God to save her people. Palin perfected the Jesus victim art of evangelical self-banishment and then took victimhood to new levels of success by cashing in on white, lower middle-class resentment of America's elites. She might as well have run under the slogan, "I'm as dumb as you are." Palin made a fortune by simultaneously proclaiming her evangelical faith, denouncing liberals, and claiming that she would help them, well, at least help the God-fearing folk out there take back their country. This Queen Esther lacked seriousness. But born-again insiders knew that the wisdom of men wasn't the point. Why should the new queen bother to actually finish her work as governing Alaska? God had chosen her to confound the wise. So she became a media star and quit as governor of Alaska. She then battled them, the lamestream media. And she labeled any media outlets outside of the far-right subculture in the name of standing up for real Americans. Palin used the alternative communication network that had its roots deeply embedded in those pioneering 1970s and 80s evangelical television shows and radio shows that I used to be on just about every other day. She did this to avoid being questioned by people who didn't agree with her. By not actually governing or doing the job she'd been elected by Alaskans to do, and by using alternative media networks as an outsider all the while, reacting to and demanding attention from the actual, theoretically hated media, Palin also made buckets of money. And in conclusion, the greatest irony was that many women in the evangelical Roman Catholic quiverful movements were cheering Palin as a defender of traditional family values. Hello? Palin was the least submissive female imaginable. She misused her children as stage props, reduced her husband to the role of helpmeet. Indeed, he became the perfect example of a good biblical wife. Speaking of good biblical wives, in the Palin era, the evangelical right still liked to pay lip service to the Puritan community as the ideal to get back to. Yet the post-Karl Rove evangelicals ignore the Puritans' actual ideals and ideas about government's biblical mandate role. The Puritans' theology of government was formed in the context of an embrace of all Christians' duty to enhance the public good. This was exemplified by such unquestioned, well-established concepts as King's Highway, a common road system protected by Crown, the government, and a common law that applied to all. One's common duty to others was accepted as the essential message of Christian civilization. Public spaces were defended by government in the early New England settlements, just as they had been in England. What's so curious is that in this religious-inflicted country of ours, the same evangelicals, conservative Roman Catholics, and others who had been running around post-Karl Rove insisting that America had a Christian foundation and demanding a return to our heritage, ignored the fact that one historic contribution of Christianity was a commitment to a strong central government. For instance, this included church support for state-funded or state church-funded charities, including hospitals, as early as the 4th century. Government was seen as part of God's plan for creating social justice and defending the common good. Christians were once culture-forming, culture-embracing people. Even the humanism preached by the supposedly anti-Christian Enlightenment thinkers of the 18th century was, in fact, deist Christian heresy, with a value system espousing human dignity borrowed wholesale from the Sermon on the Mount. In the scorched earth post-Karl Rove era, the healthcare reform debates of 2009 and beyond, evangelicals seem to believe that Jesus commanded that all hospitals and everything else should be run by corporations for profit, just because corporations weren't the evil government. The right even decided that it was normal for the state to hand over its age-old public and patriotic duties to private companies, even for military operations. The contractors, prisons, healthcare, public transport, and all the rest, in effect, nothing should belong to the government, everything to the private interest. The religious right, the far right, favored private facts, too. They claimed that global warming wasn't real. They asserted this because scientists, those same agents of Satan who insisted that evolution was real, were the ones who said human actions were changing the climate. Worse, the government said so, too. Global warming is a left-wing plot to take away our freedom. Amtrak must make a profit. Even the word infrastructure lost its respectability when government had a hand in maintaining roads, bridges, and trains. In denial of the West's civic-minded government-supporting heritage, evangelicals and the rest of the right wound up defending private oil companies, but not God creation. Private cars instead of public transport. Private insurance conglomerates rather than government health care for individuals. The price for the religious right's wholesale adultery, a private everything, was that Christ's reputation was tied to a cynical, union-busting political party owned by billionaires. It only remained for a far-right Republican-appointed majority on the Supreme Court to rule 2010 that unlimited corporate money could pour into political campaigns anonymously in a way that clearly favored corporate America and the super wealthy, who were now the only entity served by Republican parties. The evangelical foot soldiers never realized that the logic of their stand against government had played into the hands of people who never cared about human lives beyond the fact that people could be sold products. By the 21st century, mom, pa, no name were still out in the rain holding an abortion is murder sign in Peoria or standing in line all night in some godforsaken mall in Kansas City to buy a book about Sarah Palin and have it signed. But it was the denizens of the corner offices at Goldman Sachs, the News Corporation, Koch Industries, Exxon, and Halliburton who were laughing. End of quote. That's what we have. I don't have time for feedback. That's just a commentary. And keep this in mind. This administration are working as hard as they can to make sure that they give all the support needed to get all those people to vote for them. That's something you might not have been aware of. Back in a moment. Please stay with us.
It's
go to our conference call here in California and say hello to my guest, Dr. David Rico, R-I-C-H-O. He's a clinical psychologist. He's been practicing for a long time, author, spiritual leader, and he combines Jungian transpersonal and mythic perspectives in his work to address issues related to personal and spiritual growth and relationships. He teaches the University of California, Berkeley, and also Pacifica Graduate Institute, where I was filming last year. And he's also an instructor at the Esalen Institute in Big Spur, which I was at a long time ago. Nice to have you with us today.
Thank you. Nice of you to invite me.
One of the most common events we witness in the lives of people in this culture is failed relationships. Now, I'm not just referring to the relationships with a partner, but relationships we have with ourselves, with our communities, and particularly with the environment and our place in nature and the world. We could say part of this is a lack of trust, or trust being replaced by fear and avoidance. So please, if you would, speak on the reasons, at least that you see, for there being such a lack of trust in today's society. And do you see this as a phenomena that is increasing compared to other generations and times in history, or is this a problem we have always faced?
I think it's always been a human puzzle, the nature of trust, particularly since it has to be provisional. Trust is based on what the record shows. So if we were to think of trust with a dictionary definition, trust is reliance on reliability. So I rely on you because I've come to believe that you're reliable. And I can only go by the record if I keep trusting you in a relationship when I notice that you're not reliable. That's what's called codependency. And if I do trust you when you are reliable, that's the equivalent of a willingness to build up intimacy. So we live in a world in which we have the issue of whether we can trust specific people in relationships or in any area of our lives. And then we have another issue of trust, which is, can we trust the givens of life, the experiences that we all have, as suitable to help us grow? Now, I imagine there are many givens, but let's take five specific ones. There's the given that things will change and end, the given that things will not always go according to our plans, that the given that people will not be loving and reliable all the time, the given that suffering will be part of life, and the given that we don't really have control over the events that occur around us or how people behave toward us. So if we were to look at the question of trust with regard to the world itself, you can see that there are so many complicated and unreliable possibilities that the only trust we could have is that in the midst of all of these, my capacity to love and to find a path of wisdom will remain. And that is sometimes called trust in God or trust in a higher power that represents this love and wisdom. But we could also see it as something that's in our own deeper self, the part of us that is bigger than just our ego being our immediate identity, our personality. In addition to that, it seems as if over the centuries, people have come to trust a power greater than themselves, and that power is sometimes thought of as beyond us and sometimes thought of as within us, or you could see it as both within and around us. So from that point of view, we always have a reason to trust, as long as we have the kind of faith in what humanity is about and what we're here for, namely to evolve and to create a world of justice, peace, and love. So in my book, Daring to Trust, I talk about trust as, say, the center of a compass. And you have north, south, east, and west. East and west, in other words, horizontal, poses the question, can I trust myself and others? In other words, the human world. North is, can I trust higher power? And south is, can I trust reality? Can I trust that what happens is going to give me the opportunity to practice love and find wisdom? So that's my basic approach.
I appreciate these insights. Thank you. Now, let's go a little deeper on that. Perhaps one of the most difficult things for people is to discern when trusting something is psychological and spiritually honest, or when it is simply being naive or ignorantly innocent. And explain the difference between authentic trust and being naive. And I give it to, this question is important because I ask my audience, please do not attack that which you're not aware of. Keith Olbermann was attacking maliciously and constantly anyone involved with the Tea Party. And of course there are people in that movement, as there are in all movements, who are emotionally out of balance with the rest of society, who have their own agenda, and are easily pliable by outside forces, including the Koch brothers. But there are a lot of people I personally met by going to the meetings myself and speaking with people who had legitimate concerns, who were not radical, who didn't want to see all government destroyed, but their voices were not heard. And I thought, isn't it unfortunate that the people on the left nor the people on the right will step back and ask, what happens when we are ignorantly and naively innocent, we have no real harmful agenda, and therefore we're trusting someone or trusting a group or trusting the leaders of that group to use our power that we have given them for positive social change, versus coming from a psychological and spiritually honest place where we see the truth and will not align ourselves with anything that would become harmful to individuals, to other groups, or to society? That is the basis for my asking you this question. Could you address that, please?
Well, it sounds like you've addressed it very well in how you've described it, and I go back to my model of I trust that which shows over the long run that it is in favor of the evolution of humanity. How does this evolution happen? It happens when what we do, politically and personally, encourages the arrival on this planet of justice, peace, and love. So I, as an adult, I want to base my trust on what has shown itself to be in favor of that, and what has helped me also move in that direction. Okay. So our trust will always be provisional, but if we have a framework or a set of values or goals, such as justice, peace, and love, let's say, if we're operating in such a way as to always be working in that direction, then we will trust whatever helps us get there.
Makes sense. I'm going to.
And the other, I wanted to say one more thing about this. since, and this is more on a responding to the more personal issue in this, in other words, personal to us as individuals, that we will never be able to say fully or definitely that others are trustworthy. But the one thing that we can do, and the adult is always looking for this, what is it that I can do? And what we can do is we can be trustworthy, no matter how others act toward us. We don't let people take advantage of us. We don't naively keep trusting them when they show themselves not to be trustworthy. But no matter what, we ourselves act in a trustworthy way. And I consider this a highly spiritual plane on which to stand.
I agree. One last question, please. One very traumatic experience for people is when they have trusted someone sincerely and that trust is broken. Often the way we react to broken trust will shape our relationships and reactions in the future. So are there particular things you advise people to be aware of when trust is broken so it doesn't become a conditioning event in their future? And to what degree does our home environment growing up play in our ability to trust later in life, particularly in the dynamics of attachment and insecurity between parent and child? And for younger adult listeners in this audience, who either have children or are just planning to start families, what are some key suggestions you would give to parents for instilling a sense of trust in their children?
Okay, so we have two questions. One is how trust relates to early life, and then what happens when trust has been broken in an intimate relationship. For instance, one of the partners is having an affair or is in some way betraying the other. So to begin with childhood, which is where everything begins, of course, we begin our life with the necessity of feeling safe and secure. Trust is simply the other side of that coin. When our parents provide what is called a holding environment, a place for us in their family and in their arms where we feel safe to be ourselves and to be taken care of, and we feel secure that we will be loved no matter what happens, that is the origin of trust, and it's the very first challenge in human life. The very first question is, can I trust the family into which I was born? How is this trust shown? I explain this easily, I think, by referring to what I call the five A's. There are five experiences or five needs that we want to receive from our parents, and this is what helps us feel safe and secure and be able to trust them. We want them to show us attention, in other words, attention to our needs and feelings, accept us as we are, hold us with affection, that is, physically, but not sexually, appreciate us, that is, value us, and, in addition, allow us to grow in the direction that is in us, rather than to control us and try to make us into what they want us to be. So five A's: attention, acceptance, appreciation, affection, and allowing. when these come our way, at least in good enough ways, doesn't have to be perfect, but we can. The way to tell that you received these five A's is you can remember some specific instances of each one from at least one of your parents.
Great information.
This equips us to be people who are able to trust other humans, and that's the equivalent of the safety and security. Now, in a relationship, in an adult relationship, we're looking for exactly the same five A's. When these five A's are given and received between two people, that's the meaning of intimacy.
Dr. Rico, we're out of time. We have gotten a lot of good insights, and hopefully people will read the book, Daring to Trust, Opening Ourselves to Real Love and Intimacy. Thank you very much for sharing this with us today. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Dr. David Rico, R-I-C-H-O. I'm Gary Knoll. We're out of time. I want to thank you all for listening today.
There's something on my mind. Won't somebody please, please tell me what's wrong?
Gary Knoll Show is produced in our New York City studio. The producer is Richard Gale. The engineer is Matt Bogart. All shows are archived by Joe Kemp. The chief archivist is Sharon Pride. And the program director is Jason Taubenfeld.